Thanks, Dave. Wes, sorry I'm not be able to be here for the whole meeting. I've got some other things one needs to attend to. But I want to reprise a talk I gave at this Astrophysics from 5AU workshop that I guess some of you are at, and I think all of you have heard about, and he's summarized at this meeting. So for those of you who've sort of seen it before, sorry. But I'll give you a brief run through on why we care about exozodes, what it is, and then towards the end discuss a little bit about, a mission I worked on some time ago, a mission concept for the Discovery Program, actually, that would help you measure the local zodi and what you could learn about them. The exozodi, which is clearly a matter of concern for detecting exoplanets directly. So, debris disks and the formation of planets actually goes back a long way. One of my favorite quotes is from Fred Wedderburn, before the launch of IRAS, who said that accretion models of planet formation suggest there ought to be, debris left over, and that should give rise to 10 micron, an excess in the luminosity of young stars, and if you could observe, objects in Ursa Major, FGK stars, you could put constraints on the amount of debris. It's like one of these predictions of volcanoes around Io before you actually get to Jupiter. And Fred tried to make these 10 micron observations, and in the end, for reasons that I'll describe, he was unlikely to have been successful given that 10 micron excesses are rare. But with IRAS going up and making longer wavelength observations, it became clear that debris disks were in fact quite a common feature around not just young stars but older stars as well. So looking at Vega, George Amann and Fred Gillett et al. Found out that Vega was for yet more reasons a lousy calibrator and in fact had a bright excess, and then other stars followed suit, and a useful parameter is this LD over L star, the luminosity of the dusk ratioed to the luminosity of the star, and it's somewhere between a few and 100% for protostars, classical Tauri stars. The brightest debris disks, which have lost most of their protostellar disk, is in the range of 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 4. The typical IRASC, ISO, and Spitzer disks are in the range of 10 to the minus 4, maybe down to 10 to the minus 5, LD over L star. And then very weak disk systems, fairly clean systems like our own solar system, are one part in a million to one part in 10 million. And you can see the how strong the zodiacal cloud is in our own solar system. Here's a COBE map here, galactic plane, weaker at 3 microns, but still prominent in reflected light there. But this is a small optical depth, and this is also roughly the optical depth of the emitting material. So it is a challenge to pick it up, particularly if you're inside the cloud. So some of the points to consider: what's the evolution of this material? What sort of a census? How many stars have this? Where's the material located? What is the material made out of? What's the effect of planets on the distribution of this material? And then from an engineering standpoint, what is the effect of the exozodi on the direct detection of planets in other solar systems? And then finally, what could we learn about other zodiacal clouds by trying to study our own system? So, like I say, I won't go through this in a lot of detail. It's certainly the case that the fraction of stars with debris disks drops pretty rapidly with age. I think this is, a 25 micron excess from Spitzer, and you can see the fraction of stars with excesses dropping, and so that by the time you get out to a few hundreds of millions of years, it's really dropped down, and then there's just a modest fraction, 5 to 10% of field stars that have excesses out here greater than a giga year. This is mostly some A stars, also some FGKs. Same thing again, looking at ages out to 10 giga years. Again, this is, 24 microns. Things drop pretty quickly, and again, by a giga year, it's the rare but not negligible system that has a has an excess. So for later systems, there's sporadic outbursts, perhaps due to collisions or some sort of eruptive event that stirs up the debris disk. Spitzer results, just briefly from Jeff Bryden. The typical measurement that you could make of really Kuiper belt dust, which is what Spitzer was most able to measure, sort of cold material far out where there's enough contrast between the dust emission and the stellar photosphere to be able to pull it out, to get down to this sort of a level, roughly 14 to 15% of mature stars show this sort of an excess. And this is just what you might consider to be a luminosity diagram. At 10 to the minus 4, you have a few percent. By the time you get to 10 to the minus 5, you're up to 10 to 15%. And there's no real difference between the planet-bearing stars and the systems with no known planets in these diagrams within the uncertainties. Should mention that in most cases, the systems are consistent with fairly large dust grains, relatively warm dust located just outside the snow line. This is from some Spitzer work we did with Sam Lawler. And let's see, so this is LD over L star in solar system units, where I've taken 10 to the minus 7. It's the log of that. If you look at 30 to 40 microns, slightly colder dust, you sort of get a histogram like this, where you're at around 100 solar system zodis, a few detections sprinkled along in here. If you ask for what you could see at 8 to 12 microns, where the brightness of the photosphere is greater, and thus your ability to pull out dust emission is not as good, you're more in the range of something like many hundred to 1,000 zodis for any individual star. So this is sort of the distribution of systems here, and we're somewhere around a 1,000 zodis or so. And these are all, in fact, failures to detect these systems. These are upper limits. And this is one reason why Wedderburn and company had a hard time just doing their ground-based measurements. They had plenty of signal and noise, but its photometric accuracy and simply the incidence of dust clouds that are bright enough to detect that make this a real challenge at 10 microns. There's also some theoretical reasons to expect that the 10 micron emission features don't last very long. I'll get to that. So where is this material located? If you fit a simple-minded model for large dust grains, you see the distance of the emitting dust relative to the star is a few to a few tens of astronomical units. These are different colors, denote different wavelength bands from Spitzer that went into the modeling. And most of these things are located well outside the few million year snow line, so that most cases this material is pretty far out in what we would call a Kuiper belt. Only one or two have material that goes in fairly close. Yeah.
This is because that's where the emissions were made, is out of 30 to 60 microns.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily imply anything about what's going on.
Right. Right.
Terrestrial planet.
I mean, we know is that it's weaker than this. I mean, there could, as long as there's, you could have, LD over L star at the level of 100 zodis, and it simply wouldn't be detectable.
And there may or may not be a connection between those two.
Right, absolutely. And one of the things we could learn by studying our own cloud better is understanding, where does our material come from? Is it asteroidal belt in nature, and thus a few AU? Or is it stuff leaking in from the Kuiper belt through comets, which might give you a different level of emission?
Yeah, this is all beyond the ice line. Is there any actual evidence or information in the way on whether there are ices?
I'll come to that. The answer is a maybe. We have one object. I think I'm not showing it here. One HD 106 407. Probably not. I mean, there's one model that Casey was able to fit, Casey List, where you know, depending on what you put for the optical constants in, you could make a fit that the Spitzer data went through a, you know, an ice feature out of 60 microns. On the other hand, you could probably fit it just as well with bigger grains with a different spatial distribution. So there's no solid evidence for ice out there. But on the other hand, there's no evidence that it's not there for the most part. I mean, there's hope that Herschel might be able to do something with this. And, you know, that's one of the things that we're involved in. This is what you call the snow line, where you actually get the condensation, you know, where the volatiles start to condense out at a few million years of age, where presumably you've created stuff in the solar system at that point. You know, thereafter it's sort of, you know, colder. Large warm disk, yeah, okay, here's 10647. You know, maybe there's ice over here, but, you know, with two data points, complicated curve, you tell me. Not likely. You know, you could make a fit, but probably not. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it is, but, you know, it was an interesting, you know. If you could get in here with good signal to noise, which NIPS SED was not spectacular at, you know, Herschel could get in there and maybe see something. But it is the case that there are objects that have been resolved by Spitzer and have hot material that has to be pretty far away from the star, and it probably has to be small dust grains. And the reason for that is if you have a big dust grain sitting in equilibrium with its star, it absorbs the starlight and then emits it fairly frequently, easily, it's going to be fairly cold. If you have a small grain, it absorbs the starlight, it's too small compared to the wavelength at which it would like to radiate, it has to heat up and thus be a hotter grain, and thus the things we see way out here, the equilibrium temperature of the dust for big grains is so low it shouldn't be extended. The fact that we're seeing these things as quite extended at the Spitzer resolution, and you may laugh and say, oh, that can't possibly be extended. In fact, we have Hubble data that shows in a number of these cases it is extended. So there is something that says perhaps you have some small dust grains, maybe they're icy, we have to find out. And again, this is an area where Herschel will do quite a lot of work. But so this is material out at, you know, a few hundred plus astronomical units. So here's one nearby star, more relevant to our own system. It's a, you know, K star, fairly nearby, 12 parsecs, somewhere in the range of 2 to 5 giga year. It has three planets, low eccentricity, in and around 0.1 to a half an AU, and it has this excess of emission here, which when you, you know, look at it and the temperatures involved, a sort of asteroid belt, no Kuiper belt because there's no long wavelength excess. If you subtract out the photosphere, you get this fairly complicated emission structure consistent with small dust grains because you have very sharp features. The material is located right in the area of the habitable zone. I mean, this is sort of like 1.5 AU. Here are the planets. If you fit the SEDs, you get that the material is sitting probably in a 2-to-1 resonance with the most distant planet. There's some interferometer data that's consistent with this distant location. And as you try to fit the SED with various models of material, it looks like you're looking at the disruption of something like a 30-kilometer asteroid, possibly perturbed and, you know, destroyed essentially by some perturbation by some planet. This is the evolution of hot dust. This is again an explanation of why we don't see a lot of strong 10 micron excesses. Mark Wyatt has done a lot of work trying to model this. And the problem is material in close in the habitable zone evolves fairly rapidly. It evolves on the time scale of a few orbital lifetimes, so it's quick. And so if you look at the LD over L star fraction as a function of time, and depends sort of on the initial size of the disk, you find that things drop down pretty quickly. so that by the time you've gotten to a giga year, you certainly expect that most of the systems are below 10 to the minus 5, unless there's been some large stochastic event. But most of the systems ought to be down here. Our Spitzer limit is somewhere around here. The limit for making planet measurements with TPF, any sort of direct imaging system, is somewhere around here, maybe 10 to 20 zodies, and our solar system is down here quite clean. And you can see that the models suggest that in many cases the systems ought to be relatively clean. There is one interesting and unexpected fact, at least for hot stars. The interferometers, PTI, CHARA, have been finding that there's some very, very hot dust located right in at the sublimation radius for a couple of A stars. These have known exozodiac clouds, and by some mechanism not completely understood, there's a pileup of dust located in fairly close. This is a measurement from, I guess, the CHARA array showing the V-squared visibility for some point sources compared to the actual measurements of Zeta Lep. And you can see that if it were completely unresolved, you'd get something up here. And in fact, you're seeing that the V-squared measurements show there is some resolved emission, and that implies material in at a few tenths of an AU where the dust is actually just piling up before being sublimated. It has to be very small grains, otherwise you'd see a huge amount of emission at still longer wavelengths. We don't see it as presumably a transient event. Again, break up from something like possibly a 10-kilometer radius object. Would do it, maybe some sort of asteroid belt in very, very close to the star. We don't see this in a lot of systems, but the measurements haven't been made in any great number. Fomalhaut, you know, A star, very, very bright disk going back to IRAS days, 7.5 parsecs away, it's quite young. The submillimeter data and the MIPS data from Spitzer suggested that the disk was offset with respect to the star. From the submillimeter observations, we could see it was displaced by about 8 AU, and the prediction was made that there maybe is a perturbing planet in there at something like 80 to 100 AU at modest eccentricity. And when HST finally looked at this, they found the spectacular ring. They went back and looked at it later at two different epochs. They were actually able to see the perturbing planet. I mean, so this is really a canonical image in the planet-finding community. We actually see a planet in orbit around another star, and this is probably the planet that is sculpting this ring in the same way that the satellites of Jupiter are sculpting the rings on Jupiter moons. Well, Jupiter and Saturn sculpt the rings. Interesting enough, it's possible to get a dynamical mass for this object of something around 3 Jupiter masses or less. And if it was any greater than that, it would have disrupted the ring over, you know, some number of tens of millions of years. And so even though this thing is so far away from its host star, you wouldn't be able to get an astrometric or radial velocity measurement. You are able to get some sort of a dynamical measurement to try to understand the nature of this object. A whole separate talk is it's very hard to understand the nature of this object. Its emission spectrum is very peculiar. It actually looks as though this has much more visible emission than 3 and 5 micron emission. And it may well be the case that this object has its own ring system that's reflecting starlight out and making it magnitudes brighter than it ought to be compared to its 3 micron emission. I think we'll find out more about that guy in the next couple of years. It's far enough away from its host star that I think there's already at least one spectrum out in the literature about it. So, but it's a fascinating object, but it points to this influence of planets on disks. I won't go over that one. So what are the next steps in exozodiac research? Spitzer and even JW are limited by their photometric accuracy in how faint an exozodi cloud they can find. You're really trying to compare measurements at one wavelength to another, subtract the photosphere to see a small amount of emission. You're subtracting two big numbers. Your physics teacher told you not to do that. And we're limited to a few percent photometric accuracy. JWST will give you better signal noise. It won't give you better photometric accuracy. Interferometers help. They reject the stellar signal, and we can get a few milliarc seconds resolution with Keck or the Large Binocular Telescope. There's been an exozodi survey of nearby stars. That'll drive us down a factor of 5 or so below the Spitzer levels. Beyond that, the Large Binocular Telescope may get down to something like the 10 zodi level, another factor of 5 to 10 below the Keck interferometer. And that will, I think, help us in the area of pushing into the habitable zone, understanding how much material there is, and is it a threat to the direct detection of planets by imaging systems. I didn't mention here Herschel. At its long wavelengths of operation, it'll be helping to drive down limits out in the Kuiper Belt regime and maybe even getting compositional information out in the Kuiper Belts. It won't help very much down in close to the stars in the habitable zones. The ground-based limits look like this. Depending on the dust temperature, which is then where the dust is located, you get LD over L star limits for different observing systems. Here's Herschel down at a few, maybe 10 zodis, but for very cold material. Here's various limits for various Spitzer instruments. Here's the KI sensitivity. We're hoping that LBTI will come in here at somewhere between measuring systems between maybe just a 10 or a bit better, up into the range of perhaps 100 zodis. And if we have measurements of stars down to this level, as I'll show in a second, at this point we're on scale with any version of TPF. You may have to integrate a bit longer on some system, but you're not going to have any real problem finding planets in a system with 10 zodis or less. And so some modest theoretical extrapolations, I think you'd have the confidence to go ahead and do a TPF kind of detection mission. But you certainly want to get down to this level. Future capabilities, I've mentioned, JWST can do some work in scattered light, but not much below what we're presently doing with Hubble, large LD over L star systems. At 10 micron region, we'll certainly learn a lot by comparison with Spitzer, because we will have spatial resolution to study these fairly bright systems, do compositional information, but it won't push down to lower levels of zodi. As I mentioned, you need more than just more signal and noise. You need a way to get rid of the star. So why do we care about zodis? Because it's a real challenge to detecting planets. I stole these slides from Wes, who stole the idea from me. stars are bright, it's a problem. Here's the planet, there's the searchlight. We want to find the bug hidden in the glare of the searchlight. And the problem is it's hidden in the exozodiacal fog. And you have to be able to see through the fog to find the bug. And so there's a significant influence on any mission. It's both the same in the optical and in the infrared. It's basically the surface area of dust that's comparable to the surface area of the Earth you're looking at, and it's either in scattered light or it's in emitted light. It's pretty much the same problem. I won't go through it in a lot of detail, but both in the infrared or in the visible, if you add in exozodiacal emission, your integration time goes up by a factor of 2 or a factor of 3 as you get up to 8 to 10 times the amount of exozodi emission. It produces significant noise in your pixel, and you are just stuck with having to integrate longer. To the extent that there's clumps in the exozodi, that can be a source of confusion as well, particularly if you have a low resolution experiment. But so we need to get a factor of 3 more integration time. You could probably cope with which is why I say if you're in this range of 10 to 20 exozodes, it's probably not a big problem. If you just look up here as in the infrared, the noise sources you have to deal with, the local zodi is quite a lot higher than the exozodi at the one zodi level. You have to work have a pretty dusty distant system to bring the exozodi up to the point where it's even equal to the signal from the local zodi. This is just, you know, photoelectrons coming from different noise sources itself. And, you know, here's the exozodi, here's our local zodi, which you can't really get out of unless you take your whole observatory out to 5 AU, which is a good thing to do, but probably expensive. So people have talked about next steps, a dedicated space mission to look for zodis. There's the Pegasus mission in Europe, which was a 5 to 10 micron interferometer. With the low backgrounds in space, you could push right down with the nulling system to probably a one zodi measurement. Beldanchi has proposed another interferometer that could basically baby Spitzer on a stick that would work. Carl and John Trager proposed visible coronagraphy from space in various space missions, Eclipse and so on. Whether or not they could do, you know, Jupiter's with a small system that you could do for the price of a probe, it could certainly do a great job on zodis down to this level and maybe a few planets. And I guess, Carl, you'll talk about what you could do, you know, from a still more modest system on a balloon. And, you know, so there are ways to make progress, but you do have to really hit head on the problem of getting rid of the starlight. So what could we learn about exozodis from a local zodi mission or an experiment? You know, I proposed it one or two times sort of for discovery and explore, you know, quite a long time ago now. And it's still a good idea. We actually know more about exozodis than we do the local zodi, particularly beyond something like 3 AU. You know, try to understand, if you're sitting in the LA Basin and you're looking out towards Palm Springs on a smoggy day, and you want to say, gee, how smoggy is it out at Palm Springs? The fact that you're looking through this column that's full of crud between you and the Banning Pass makes it almost impossible to find out what the small incremental level of crud is out from the Banning Pass to Palm Springs. You need to get out beyond 3 AU to understand what's going on with the zodi outside of the asteroid belt, which is presumably the origin of at least a significant fraction of the material in the inner solar system. So you'd like to just follow the steepness of the drop-off and the local zodi as you go out radially. You'd like to then understand how the physical properties change as you go out for both in-situ measurements, perhaps you have a dust collector, and just by spectroscopy on the local zodi as you go out there. And eventually, you know, you want to get away from the light pollution and the fog. 1AU in space is a great place for observatories in the late 20th century, but if you could take something like JWST and go out to 5AU with it, if you could get that done, then your backgrounds at 1 to 5 to 10 microns would drop by factors of a lot, even more sensitive. I don't think we'll propose that to the project right now. They have enough problems. So we proposed this thing called the Local Zodi Mapper back in 1996. A number of the people in this room were on it, or people who were at the 5AU meeting. And there's Bill Reach. John Mather was out at the 5AU meeting in Irvine. You know, Harvey Mosley. A number of us were there, Ned Wright and so on, and we wanted to see, okay, here's the inner solar system, here's the outer part of the dust cloud, what does it actually look like? So if you look at what are the various components in the local zodiacal cloud and how do they change, you know, what's their area as a function of distance, you have sort of asteroid material, primary and beta meteorites around, concentrated around 2 to 5 AU, you know, stuff coming in from the from the Kuiper belt, interstellar medium material coming in, and all these things change as a function of distance in the solar system.
What are the comets on them?
I think that's this thing called HALO, I'm not sure. I mean, I haven't looked at this proposal in 15 years. So this was a figure, but it's the only one I could find late last night after the ball game.
Well, it's an issue right now, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are better references than this. I know that there's been some more recent work by Stan and Mark Kutchner and so on, and we'd have to find a more up-to-date figure going forward. Bill, I know you may have one in your... Yeah, we just need to find what the latest one is. You know, this was a lot of water under the bridge since this graph was put together. But I think it is the case that there'll be models which show different distributions coming from the asteroid belt, from the comets, stuff that's been ejected from the asteroid belt going out as beta meteorites and so on. And that's the sort of thing you'd be able to study.
That was really my question.
Yeah.
Can you really tell the difference between where it came from?
Well, I mean,
does the stuff get evaporated in the inner solar? I mean, you don't have to solve it.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you'd find is a plot like this, more current, that showed different species as you go out. And certainly, there's a net drop in the amount of material as you go outward. So studying that distribution of material as a function of radius by itself would tell you something.
Sounds logical.
You know, if you do spectroscopy on that as well, I'm sure it could do it. I just haven't paid a lot of attention to that in the last couple of years. The reason that going out to many AU makes for a fabulous observatory site is the brightness at the poles. You know, so here's one AU. You know, being out in space is actually a terrible place to be at one AU. It's a lot better than being on the ground at 10 microns. You know, on the ground is sort of up here somewhere. So this is great when you do IRAS or Spitzer or WISE or any of those things. But you could gain another factor of a couple of two or three orders of magnitude if you put your observatory out at 5 AU. Great stuff. And so this is the measurement you would be trying to make as you go from 1 AU out to 3 AU all the way out to 5 AU. That's the drop that you'd see, that's the measurement you'd like to make, and you'd want to relate that drop to, you know, even first you have to take out the temperature dependence, and you'd relate that back to the density of material as you go out radially. Now you can see that even at 5 microns, there's a pretty steep drop here. A lot of that, of course, is simply the black body curve, but some of it is also simply the decrease in the amount of material. And a 5-micron system is a relatively modest thing to put on any satellite that's going out to the outer solar system. Doing stuff out at longer wavelengths, you know, the detectors want to be colder and so on, and that could get sort of hard. But, you know, 2 to 5 microns, I mean, here's 3 microns, there's still a big drop. And so any measurements you can make, even in here, you're going to be able to relate back to the amount and nature of emitting material as you go outwards in the solar system. So we put together this modest concept. Here's a 200 kilogram satellite. Here's a little baby telescope. This is like 10 centimeters. Everything's sort of passively cooled. You get outer shield temperatures with 3 shields going down to something like 25 to maybe even 20 degrees, which is more than adequate to bring 1 to 5 micron detectors into a very happy place. And then if you have a little cryostat down here, you can do longer wavelengths as well. We looked at a 1 by 3 AU orbit. You need to get to 3 AU just to get outside the asteroid belt. You'd actually like to go to 5 AU. But we found that was really hard. This is why planetary missions are tough. There's no power out there. The communications coming back is pretty expensive and hard to come by, sort of like a dial-up line. And so 3 AU is the minimum that we could do, you know, the most that we could do with sort of a simple mission. In fact, we didn't even have enough mass margin to do that properly within the budget that we were trying to fit into at the time. So if you could hitch a ride with something like a 5-micron system, you could get cold detectors. That would be pretty straightforward. You wouldn't need a cryostat for them. And with the few kilograms that would take, you could do a pretty nice job. Can't be too small a telescope because you do have to reject the starlight. I mean, one of the problems that COBE had, one of its limiting features at 3 microns, even at 1 AU, was being able to reject the stars in its beam, because it was a very large beam, you know, 0.7 degree system, and just the residual popcorn noise of the stars, even if after you subtracted them out, was enough to set limits as to how well they could do. So you can't do it with a trivial size telescope, but the sort of things that you're talking about with New Horizons, you know, could well be plausible. And if you know, if you get down to here, I mean, what I haven't put in here is this is only this is ZODI plus local galactic Cirrus. You know, you're starting to see now Cirrus starting to dominate, but you know, down in here, you're starting to see the extragalactic infrared background, which is an interesting topic for the cosmology people, which links it into another branch of NASA astrophysics. And so one of the things we talked about at the Irvine meeting was all the cosmologists were there saying, oh, let's get rid of this local ZODI. It's a noise source. Well, we here are interested in the local ZODI about what it can tell us, and the CIRB is sort of our noise source. So, but that is an interesting thing that once you get far enough out, the local ZODI goes away, you can make a direct measurement of a number that's of considerable cosmological interest as well. Yeah. That's this guy right here. Well, great science, you know, not enough, you know, wasn't planetary enough. You know, also, you know, I mean, just the dust in the solar system was not of great interest to the planetary community. It was one of these things where it was a mission that fell into the gap. Probably before then. Yeah, it is before then. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the other thing that, you know, people noted is that, you know, the local ZODI is strong enough that the exo-ZODI isn't really a big driver in making measurements and trying to detect other planets, so we don't really care about learning about local ZODI very much. And as a pure planetary question, they weren't so interested in it. Plus, they just felt it was risky. We, you know, getting 200 kilograms out there for the budget that we had and so on was just seen as too unlikely to succeed. So they had technical problems as well. But they thought, you know, the science was right, that, you know, this was a good payload, where, you know, that, you know, this part would all work. It's just that, you know, getting out to 3AU with a functioning astronomical satellite, astrophysical satellite, is tough. You know, going at, leaving 1AU is really a problem. You get power, you get communications, we got cryostats, you know, we had all those issues. But I think the one thing they did point out that I took away from that is that you can be liked by two divisions and loved by neither one. And that's what led me to the comments that I made earlier. You need to be loved by somebody. Yeah, and it didn't work, so. Oh yeah. I mean, we had other issues as well, you know, so I'm sure there were a variety of reasons why we didn't get selected, but it was certainly clear that we weren't anybody's highest priority. I think that may be, so that's it. So, I mean, finding a way to do this by hitching a ride, I think is the most likely way that we'll succeed. We won't get all the data we would like. I don't think we'll get much beyond 5 microns just because the detector issues are sufficiently complicated. But even getting a 5 micron measurement that goes all the way out to many AU, about the only thing you have to add is a dark slide.
What about
I mean, at that point, you're doing the what about ultraviolet? You're doing scattered light. I'm not sure what the UV. Yeah, I mean, I just haven't thought about it. I mean, if you're trying to measure the ZODI as you go out, clearly a broad wavelength band will help you better understand the composition of the grains. I mean, if you're looking at pure ultraviolet albedo versus visible versus, you know, 5 micron emission, which by that point is also scattering, you'd like to have, you know, visible UV near infrared to give you an idea of what the wavelength dependence of the albedo is. That gives you information on the composition of the grains. Got to be good.
Because the horizon has a UV spectrometer.
Yeah.
To look for the disk that Pluto may have.
Mm-hmm.
That trying to search for that disk.
I mean, I think I haven't thought about it, so you have to look at the sensitivity issues. At some point, you're just not getting a lot of photons from scattered light off of the few dust grains that are sitting out there. Now, Carl, have you worried about that at all? Yeah. So you'd have to look at the sensitivity and just see.
Yeah. And most of the solar system missions have, you know, visible imagers hooked up to their, you know, biggest apertures. So just looking at scattered light with visible would seem a lot easier than UV.
Yeah. But, you know, anything that, you know, that works that gets you another wavelength or another piece of spectrum, got to be a good thing.
Okay, well, in the next talk is Carl Staplefield, and he's also going to talk on
posterity here.
Here, Carl.
Okay.
This one, I guess.
So I guess my question is, how do we deal with this, Dave, in the report, which we presumably should be thinking about pretty soon here, you know, some analysis that would lead to a recommendation. Do we need, or maybe we'll hear from Bill Reach this afternoon more about it, but do we need some kind of study or paper showing what the expected ZODI brightness will be as a function of distance in AU from various sources? And I'm harping on that again, you know, comets or something else. What do we need before we can actually say that this is, a step beyond 1996? Yeah, well, that's the, I guess I would call it the political aspect of it. And, well, I mean, it's...
It's hard for me to quantify.
I don't mean it in a negative way, yeah.
You know, it's really the impression I had, whatever technical flaws you may have had, is also the sense that the planetary guys just said, this is not my most important topic. And, you know, I'm sure the astrophysics guys would have said, this is not my most important topic either. Yeah.
And this is 1 year after this discovery.
Mm-hmm.
So the field is
extremely
young.
So is I.
Big. So the things have changed over years.
Yeah, no. Certainly if NASA says, we really want to do a mission like this, you know, the trouble is NASA tends not to put out directed calls.
I think what Mario is saying is that if this is written down and it appears in the report, it would be much more helpful than if it is just vibrations in the air in this room.
And it's certainly the case that, I mean, the thing we really have to do, and one of the criticisms we got in the proposal, is people said this is not the most important impediment to detecting, you know, planets. You know, what, you know, we don't really care what the origin of the exozodi is. We just want to know that there's some systems clean enough where we don't have to think about it.
You were a solution looking for a problem,
yeah, exactly.
Almost.
And we had a modestly interesting science question.
Correct.
But it wasn't that interesting a science
14 years later, the exosodi have become the biggest problem, okay? It's a hot topic. So it's a completely, I would say, it's a completely different environment now, because at that time there had not been any direct imaging of planets.
Yeah.
Had not been any detection of atmosphere and planet. Had not been any, had been probably three exoplanets found in 96. By then, okay, no more than that. Now we have 430. So a lot of things happened during that time. And I said here that a lot of this thing were truly, all planetary was truly classical planetary studies in our solar system. Mm-hmm. Now, 14 years later, that had changed. Most people are doing exoplanet along the same, in the same program that they were dominated by planets in our solar system. So I would say that is a big change that may contribute to a better reception. So.
I think that, but I think, I love this idea. I spent a lot of time thinking about it. If I were to be sitting on a review panel and say, what's the most important thing to do on exozoty, it would actually be measuring exozotys of other systems at the 1 to 10 zoty level, not trying to make a
extrapolation from the local
from our own system
from the local to the
there. I mean, that would be the more important measurement to make. On the other hand, if I had a few millions of dollars to spend on putting a dark slide into a camera that was going out to Saturn and spend a few million bucks, you know, operating in cruise phase to answer this question, because it's interesting scientifically and might help make some link between comets and asteroids and dust, it'd be an interesting thing to do. At the mission level, I don't think it's the right project. But for something interesting to do for a modest cost, turning on a 5-micron camera while they're cruising, good idea.
Well, you just brought up a third point now that should be brought out of this presentation, and that is the solar system, exosystem connection. You know, whatever we can learn about how things operate in the solar system by going out there and measuring is applicable to how we model other systems, and so that's a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, this is the only system we can do tomography on.
Yeah.
On the other hand, as Carl will tell you, in some ways it's easier to look at distant systems from the outside of the cloud. Yeah, we can measure them, you can see rings and do all this stuff. It's tough doing it inside as well. So, but I think it'd be a great idea to turn on a camera and get some data as we go out. Anything we can do to make that happen, I'd be happy to support.
In 1995, December 5th, I believe, when launched SOHO, mm-hmm. okay, to study the sun 24/7, there were a lot of people against that. They said, we already know the sun. Sun is so bright, we won't learn anything. Now, 15 years later, we have learned so much about the sun, and we're still fascinated. Mm-hmm. Sending mission after mission to do direct imaging on the sun. And to me, that shows that we don't know enough of the thing. And let me repeat a statement that I heard, that the greatest barrier, you know, for to acquire more knowledge is not really ignorance, it's the illusion of knowledge.
Absolutely.
Okay? We thought that solar physics in this country was dead in 1995. I was working at Goddard, and we had to hire every guy that was had any knowledge in solar physics. We're all European. Solar physics had closed their doors in this country in the early 90s and late 80s, because they thought this field is dead, there's nothing we can learn. 1995, December, when they launched SOHO, we learned about all the Kreutz comets, right? Mm-hmm. All the magnetic recognition and 100 other interesting things. So to me, it's like the exosolar is the same issue. It's all people say, we already know everything we're going to know. But really, when we get there, we learn so many new things that is impressive. So to me, that's
mission,
I
agree with you. I think we could learn a lot more about our local zodiac. The mission that we talked about in some later version, we never submitted it, that in addition to the photometry that I described here, was also a dust collector. What's the guy's name? Grun, Ed Grun? Everhart Grun has pushed from the planetary side to basically do, collect dust as you go out as a function of distance. You can get velocity, you can get particle sizes, and it actually samples a different size regime than what you're seeing photometrically. And so, in fact, that combination of mission is quite a powerful one and might appeal more to the planetary community as well, because, you know, having just done Genesis came back and brought back the dust and then hit the desert. You know, I mean, there was a whole mission to do that sort of thing. And if you did it radially outward, you don't get the sample back, but you get a lot of information about it. So that plus photometry, again, if NASA called for this as being interesting, would be, or the Cato Committee said this is interesting, would give it a boost. Mm-hmm.